Welcome to The Point. I'm John Basile. Jazz developed in America beginning in the early years of the 20th century. By the 1920s, it was rapidly becoming the standard for popular music in the country, and the first big stars of jazz were beginning to emerge. They were led by Louis Armstrong, whose brilliant trumpet playing and soulful singing made him an international attraction.
Hold me close and hold me fast. The magic spell you cast. This is Love Unrolls.
Also emerging was Edward Kennedy Duke Ellington, a composer, pianist, and bandleader whose greatest achievement was finding the right musicians and creating songs and arrangements that showed off their talents. The third great jazz star to emerge in the early years was Count Basie, whose band roared out of Kansas City with a rhythm that could not be ignored and soloists that were among the best. These three faced challenges of being black in America, but they overcame any obstacles in their way and made music that is as fresh and important today as it was generations ago. Larry Tye has written a triple biography of Armstrong, Ellington, and Basie called The Jazz Men, in which he explores not only their music, but the times in which they lived and the legacy they left. Larry, you are one of the more prolific biographers around these days. You've written about Bobby Kennedy, Satchel Paige, and many others. How do you choose a subject, or does the subject choose you?
Toughest thing that any author faces is not how to research a book or write their book or even find a publisher. By far the toughest decision is how to find their topic. And I want to suggest that my latest topic, my new book that I'm working on, came from the single source that more authors go to than anywhere else, and that is the New York Times obituary pages. Because every day, hundreds of thousands of people die in the world, and they get to pick the three most interesting ones, and each of them is worth a biography. But in the case of Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, my idea came from an earlier book that I wrote about some black men known as the Pullman Porters, who worked on these sleeping cars that traveled the country. And when I got done writing about them, these extraordinary Pullman Porters said, "Someday you have to write a book about our three favorite passengers." And I think the reason that the Porters loved these jazzmen and the reason the jazzmen loved the Porters says a lot, not just about music, but about America. And if I could tell you a very quick story about that reason, I'd love to. And that is that even when Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie were arguably the three best-known black Americans in the world and three of the best-known Americans on the planet, when they traveled below the Mason-Dixon line, if they picked the wrong restaurant to try to eat at or the wrong hotel to try to book a room, that could be the most fateful decision they ever made. They could be berated, they could be beaten, and in the worst cases, but in too many cases, they could end up at the end of a lynching noose. And so what they did when they went south was they hired a private Pullman sleeping car to take them on their travels. And so if they were doing a concert one night in Atlanta, at the end of the night, they would know they had a great bed made up for them by the Pullman porters. They had a delicious meal cooked by the dining car staff waiting for them. And most of all, they had a safe place where they could go. And what they did in return for the Pullman porters was, in the middle of the night, in this closed capsule of a Pullman car, they played a private concert for the Pullman porters and the dining car guys. And John, I don't know about you, but if I could go back to any moment in history, it would be having the Duke Ellington band play for me and that acoustical dream world of a railroad car.
Larry, I'd like to ask a little bit about the art of the biographer. In the case of a historical biography like this, your subjects have been dead for many years, and so many of the primary sources, people who knew them, are gone as well. How do you research a book like this?
You don't give up is basically it. I would assume that I had reached dead ends, especially with Count Basie, not just because he was dead and gone, but because his memoir was the deadliest autobiography that the world has ever produced. And I decided that I wasn't going to give up. And I tried genealogists, and genealogists ended up being a brilliant help in my figuring out that Count Basie had had a brother that he might not have known had preceded him into the world, because his brother died of malnutrition. And the brother's existence and the fact that his parents covered it up for much of Count Basie's youth offered me insight into the kind of family and the reason that he was as secretive as he was. You had to basically try and try again to reach people who turned out to be great sources, but that's why it took 250 interviews to assemble the book.
When you latch onto a topic, especially a three-part topic like this one, are there emotional highs and lows? Maybe you uncover something, as you mentioned, something new, or a lead turns out to be not as good as you expected?
Well, so I want to start by telling you that I was very naive, and I thought that if you were writing biographies of three people, you only had to do a third of the work for each of them. And my naivety was evidenced when I printed out my notes from my interviews and from the readings that I had done, and it turned out to be 10,000 pages of notes that I had to somehow put together in a form that might make for a decent book. And it was so much more work than I had ever envisioned, but it was incredibly fun because these were three characters whose lives and careers on and off the stage were so intertwined that being able to write about the three of them meant that I could look at trends, not just what had happened with one jazz great, but what was going on in an entire era. They lasted, all of them, for 50 years with their careers, and those 50 years were overlapping, and so were their life stories.
You seem to get access to really important documents, even personal letters. It's almost like being admitted to somebody's home and just having free rein. How in the world do you get, I'm thinking of some Count Basie letters that are really kind of intimate letters between the Count and his wife. How do you get access as a biographer to documents like this?
In the art of being an obnoxious journalist, and that's what I am for first and foremost, and it is not taking no for an answer. And so the Basie letters, I can't tell you, because I promised not to, the exact source who gave me access to them before they were made public at the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. But it is just talking to lots of people and having them understand that you're trying to tell a story as completely as you can. And they will sometimes open up things that were closed, and they will sometimes give you access to things that they probably oughtn't to give you access to.
In The Jazz Man, you focus on a time in America when Black people couldn't eat in certain restaurants, stay in certain hotels, live in certain neighborhoods, and that's just a few of the indignities they had to endure. These three men rose above all of that. Was it just their talent, or did they possess some secret that helped them succeed?
I think it was partly the magic of their personalities and partly the genius of their music. When you were producing the kind of music that Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie did, you could get away with a whole lot. And yet they still faced racial indignities. When Duke Ellington went one night to perform a concert in Lynchburg, Virginia, his manager went to every hotel owner in Lynchburg and said, "Will you put up Duke and the band?" And all of them said no. He finally talked one manager into doing that, but the manager said, "Of course you know they will have to pay twice the normal price." And Duke's manager said, "What do you mean twice the price? Why?" And the hotel owner explained, "Because of course we will have to burn the sheets and pillowcases that they used, because what white person is going to sleep on a bed that had the sheets and pillowcases that a Black person had just slept on?" And that was true. Those kinds of things happened repeatedly, even when they were world famous.
Basie, Ellington, and Armstrong, while growing up, around the same time, they were really just a few years apart in age, they had differing backgrounds that must have helped to shape who they became. In Armstrong's case, he came from almost unimaginable poverty. What can you tell us about his early years in New Orleans?
We grew up in a neighborhood in Jim Crow, racially segregated New Orleans. The neighborhood was so rough that it was called the battlefield. And his life, I think, but more importantly, he thought, his life was saved by, at age 13, on New Year's Eve, his borrowing his stepfather's pistol. He shot it in the air, making noise the way everybody was doing on New Year's Eve. And a very large member of the New Orleans Police Department grabbed him by the scruff of the neck, put him in a paddy wagon, and he ended up spending the next 18 months in reform school. A reform school whose very name suggested how unfriendly it was. It was called the Colored Waif's Home. And Lewis said in later years that that saved his life. He learned while he was there how to do one thing better than anybody else could do, which was the motto of Booker T. Washington, the Black philosopher of that era. And what he learned to do was first to play a bugle, then to play a cornet, and finally to play his world-famous trumpet. And he did that, and while his friends who were, he left on the streets generally didn't make it out of their teenage years, Louis Armstrong lived not just a long life, but a life where, as we all know, he for 50 long years stayed at the very top of his profession.
Now, Duke Ellington had a much different childhood, didn't he?
He did. So he grew up in the middle of the biggest Black middle-class community in America in Washington, D.C. And when he was a kid, in one of the quite stately homes that he lived in, every morning he would walk down a steep staircase and he would tell his nephews at the bottom to bow to him. He would tell his nieces it was appropriate to curtsy, and he would tell his parents and his uncles and aunts, someday the world is going to know me as the great and the grand Duke Ellington. He, over the course of his life, told a dozen stories on where his name came from, but I'm convinced that he crowned himself Duke at a very young age, and he lived up to his aristocratic aspirations.
Now, as for Count Basie, he seemed to have an upbringing, at least economically, sort of in between the other two. Am I reading that right?
You're reading it precisely right. He was born to a father who was a gardener, to a mother who was a laundress, in a place called Red Bank, New Jersey. And if listeners don't know where Red Bank is, the one thing I can tell you about it is don't bother going there. The only thing special about Red Bank is that Count Basie came from here. But Count Basie couldn't wait to get the heck out of Red Bank. He initially thought about joining the circus, and when that didn't pan out, he realized he had a skill with the keyboards that would let him not just get out of Red Bank, but go anywhere he wanted. So he made it to New York. He trained with the famous Fats Waller, and he went back to Red Bank only when he had to.
Yeah, I think you've hit on something there. Armstrong, Ellington, and Basie, they all had that sort of wanderlust. They needed to go away from the place where they came from.
They did. So they shared several things that made me want to write about them as a group. They shared the fact that they were born within 5 years of one another at the end of the last century. They shared the fact that they all wanted to get the heck out of where they came from. They shared the fact that they didn't have much use for their fathers, but they adored their mothers. And they shared the fact that they were all musical geniuses, which you don't need me to tell you.
I'm John Basile, talking with biographer Larry Tye about his book, The Jazz Man. It's about Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie. Let's hear more Louis Armstrong.
Hello, Dolly. This is Louis, Dolly. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dolly. I can tell, Dolly. You still growing, you still going strong. I feel the room swaying, but the band's playing one of our old favorite songs from way back when. So snap, fellas. Dolly, never go away again.
You're with The Point on CAI. More in a moment. John Basile talking with biographer Larry Tye about his book, The Jazz Man. It's about Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie. Armstrong, Basie, and Ellington were, I mean, it goes without saying, supremely talented musicians. They lived in the public eye for many years, and they were heroes, as you say, but none of them were saints either. And I like the fact that you don't overlook their shortcomings in this triple biography you've written.
One of the things I think is a responsibility of a biographer is when you are writing about somebody who you think of as the embodiment of evil, the way I did when I wrote a biography of Joe McCarthy, or when you're writing about your heroes, in my case, Bobby Kennedy, and we're talking about Bobby Kennedy the Elder, Bobby Kennedy, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, or Count Basie, if you can't find something that was wrong with them, then you're not looking hard enough. And in the case of Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, they all were God-fearing men who read the Bible and who prayed before meals, but they also were men who violated on a regular basis at least 5 of the 10 commandments. And the one that was most obvious with all of them was the idea of remaining faithful to your spouse. Lewis had 4 wives, and even with the 4th and longest lasting, he cheated regularly. Duke had only 1 wife, but he left her after about 4 or 5 years, and he had mistresses stashed in just about every city he traveled to. And Count Basie had only 2 wives, but his second one learned of his infidelities, and she would set an increasingly high condition on taking him back. And in the end, the condition was that he put all of his considerable assets into his wife and his daughter's name because she didn't trust him.
Was there a common thread? They all seemed to navigate that infidelity through through a long period of time. Was there a common thread how they did this?
They did. So the common thread had something in common with the Kennedy family that I had just written about. The common thread was justifying it by saying, we're on the road so much, we're away from our wives, we love them and do right by them when we're with them. And you could call that a common thread, or you could call it a common rationalization. And I would prefer the latter.
Each of these 3 musical greats you write about seem to have their own personal quirks, a lot of them revolving around medical issues and health-related issues. Did you find that to be true?
That was absolutely true. I found that Duke Ellington was the classic hypochondriac. I think if you open Webster's dictionary, you will see Duke's picture next to the definition of hypochondriac. He thought he was catching cold in every hotel room he went into, so he had them turn off the air conditioning. He imagined every illness out there that he thought that he had. The medical issues with Louis Armstrong had to do with his decision early on in his adult life that the cure for everything was a big fat joint. And he would begin every morning on the toilet seat rolling a fat joint and smoking it. He would end every evening in his dressing room smoking a joint. And he was convinced that marijuana could cure all the ills of the world. With Count Basie, the medical story is a little bit different. And it was that he was so determined late in life to keep playing that even when he had to get around on the stage with a wheelchair because his arthritis made it so difficult for him to move his joints, he still found the physical strength to move his hands and his fingers enough to produce brilliant music on the keyboard. And so his was just not accepting old age and not accepting disabled arthritis. but medical issues. I have an entire chapter on medical issues because they reflected the unique personalities of these three amazing jazz greats.
These three men came of age in the teens and early 1920s. They experienced enormous social change in America, the Depression, world wars, and politics must have entered into their lives and their careers for all three of them, really. I know famously in the case of Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington to some extent, how did they all navigate the political landscape?
They navigated it very dexterously. They said, when anybody asked them, what about your politics? They said, oh, we let our music speak for itself. But if I could tell you very quick stories with each of them, how they went beyond that, and this is what my book is really about. With Count Basie, as early as 1948, he inserted into every contract that he wrote, I will not come to your town unless you accept my integrated band and unless your venue is integrated. And on the, you know, cusp of, on the back end of World War II, to say that was unprecedented. With Duke Ellington, he showed his real racial stripes when he visited Baltimore, and students at Johns Hopkins University talked him into joining a sit-in at a local whites-only diner. And the headline in newspapers across the country the next day was, Ellington integrates diner. He forced the diner to integrate, and he paid the price of getting arrested as part of that. With Louis Armstrong, it was the most profound of all. Louis Armstrong was regularly called by the press and called by white and black activists an Uncle Tom, if not an Aunt Jemima. And one day, a young journalist showed up at his hotel door and said, Mr. Armstrong, I would like to know what you think of the ongoing confrontation in Little Rock, Arkansas. Now, in 1957, a federal judge ordered all-white Central High School integrated, and the governor of Arkansas, a well-known racist named Orville Faubus, said, you will integrate this over my dead body. When the journalist asked Armstrong what he thought about that, he called Orville Faubus a word that I won't use over this public radio station, but it began with M, it ended with R, and it got translated in family newspapers to an uneducated plowboy. He called our war hero President Dwight Eisenhower, who had refused to send in federal troops, he called him a gutless so-and-so. And the next day, in newspapers across the country, the same guy they were calling an Uncle Tom, they were now calling an unpatriotic American. But the key was that one person in America, beyond anybody else, listened to what he said, and that was a guy named Dwight Eisenhower. And a couple weeks later, and I can't prove the cause and effect, but I believe it to the bottom of my heart, the cause and effect led to Dwight Eisenhower sending in federal troops to protect what became known as the Little Rock Nine, these nine black kids. They integrated federal high school, and I think we can thank Louis Armstrong.
This was at a time, too, in contrast to today, when the federal government was very fond of sending American jazz musicians overseas to represent the best of America. Look at this great music we produce here by black people, by white people, all kinds of people make this great music, and it's our greatest export, and we want the world to see it. And that's being pulled back now in very dramatic ways. And they, each one of them, I don't know about Basie, but I know Ellington and Armstrong did, they went abroad as ambassadors.
Went abroad as ambassadors, and it wasn't just they generally went abroad. They went to behind the Iron Curtain into the Soviet Union, and they went to all the critical unaligned nations that America and the Soviets were competing for. And they were the best ambassadors America ever sent, which is why Dwight Eisenhower did that, which is why Jack Kennedy continued doing that, and which ought to be an alarm bell on why America should not stop today using its soft power to influence the world.
As we mentioned, all three of these musicians, Armstrong, Ellington, Basie, they had huge audiences in this country and around the world. What allowed them, what gave them this great appeal to such diverse audiences?
It was two things. One was obviously their music. You listen to the Count Basie Orchestra, whether you're in Russia or London or on Cape Cod, and if your toes didn't tap, they used to say you should go see a doctor the next day because something was anatomically wrong with you. Their music was part of their appeal, but the other was their humanity. You couldn't watch Louis Armstrong on stage without smiling, and not smiling at him, but smiling with him, because he was such a joyful presence. He was also the only guy in the world who could take a voice that raspy and make it into the most famous voice in jazz. And they used to say back in that era, when Armstrong was coming up in Chicago, which is where he really got launched, young men used to, in the dead of winter, stick their head out the window of the car, hoping they would catch cold so they could sound like Louis Armstrong.
It's The Point on CAI. I'm John Basile, talking today with biographer Larry Tye about his book, The Jazz Man. It's a look at the lives of three great jazz musicians from the early years, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie. More in a moment, but first let's hear more Count Basie. It's The Point on CAI. I'm John Basile, talking with biographer Larry Tye about his book, The Jazz Man. It's about Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie, the first three great stars of American jazz.
What good is melody? What good is music if it ain't possessing something sweet? Now, it ain't the melody, and it ain't the music. There's something else that makes this tune complete. Yes, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Well, it don't mean a thing. All you got to do is sing. It makes no difference if it's sweet or hot. Just give that rhythm everything you've got. Yes, don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Now, to bring this story home a little bit here to our area, Cape Cod, Louis Armstrong gave a string of performances annually, I guess, on Cape Cod in Hyannis at the now-gone Legion Hall. It was one of those performances that Cape Codder Jack Bradley first heard Armstrong play and became a huge fan. They later became great friends. Bradley amassed a collection of Armstrong memorabilia that is world-class. That story must have been an interesting little side trip as you research this.
So the idea that all three of these guys were playing in New England just about every summer of their career, what happened was it got hot in New York, and all of their fans were trying to escape the city and its heat, and they went to places like Maine and New Hampshire, and closest to my heart, they came to Cape Cod, and so did their favorite jazz stars. And the idea of Armstrong being here and then developing that magical connection to Jack Bradley, one of the only regrets that I had with this book is that while Jack was incredibly gracious in welcoming me into his home and telling me stories, it was near the end of his life where his memory was not good. And so with his wife's help, we drew upon as many of those stories as we could. But what I had to do to get to Jack Bradley stories was turn to an extraordinary book about jazz on Cape Cod written by a guy named John Basile. And that gave me the Jack Bradley stories that I wish that I had been able to get myself and wish that I'd gotten to Jack at an earlier point. But there is a Cape Cod connection to these three maestros. And there is, as you know much better than me, a Cape Cod era of jazz excellence with Storyville, with clubs all over the place that I kept hearing about. And it made me wish that I had lived on Cape Cod in that golden age of jazz here on this peninsula.
Is there a particular song that you think, I want to ask you this of each of the three musicians you write about, is there a particular song or era of their musical careers that defines these people? Start with Armstrong, if you will.
Sure. So in Louis Armstrong, the defining song, his signature song, says everything about him. It was a song called When It's Sleepy Time Down South. And it was a song that people who didn't know him could listen to and think he was romanticizing the plantation life he left behind. But anybody who knew about his coming up in that Jim Crow era of harsh racial segregation knew that it was his trying to tell us about that life, not in a romantic way, but in a way assuming that once we really understood what it was like when it was sleepy time down south, we would protest that kind of Jim Crow restriction.
Folks are crooning south in love. You didn't tell me, boy, because I know, yes. When it's sleepy time down south, yes. The south wind blowing through the pinewood trees. The folks down there live a life of ease. When old mammy falls on her knees, yes. When it's sleepy time down south, yes. Steamboats up the river coming and going, but under the river possess. Splashing the night away, babble-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da and our folks are singing and they dance till the break of day. Yeah, dear old Southland, with this dreamy song, you take me back where I belong, right in my mammy's arms. By God's zat, bele ya de do do zat. Good evening, everybody.
Duke Ellington's theme song, which you know certainly because you're the jazz expert, and all your listeners presumably know, was more than anything, it was Take the A-Train, but people may not know where that song came from. A lot of people assume that Ellington composed it. In fact, there was a brilliant young kid who lived in Pittsburgh named Billy Strayhorn, who wanted a job with Duke Ellington. And Ellington said, when you graduate from high school, call me. So 5 minutes after he graduated, Strayhorn was on the phone. Ellington said, I remember my promise, come to New York and we'll talk. He mailed Strayhorn directions, which of course included at the end, take the A train in Harlem to where Ellington lived. Strayhorn, who was a genius, thought, if I can compose a song based on the directions Ellington sent me, he will hire me. Well, it worked. He composed a great song. Ellington hired him. The only problem was when Ellington would play that song every night, it was only one of three performances that he would decide to credit Billy Strayhorn. And the rest of the time, the audience understandably assumed it was Ellington's song. And lastly, with Count Basie, his most rocking song was 1 o'clock Jump. But to me, his best signature song was a song that he performed with Frank Sinatra doing the vocals called Fly Me to the Moon. And it was a song that was so terrific that the Apollo astronauts took it to the moon with them. And when Walter Cronkite down on Earth was saying, what do you listen to up there? The song skyrocketed to the top of the charts because the Apollo astronauts said, we love the Basie Sinatra, Fly Me to the Moon.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, and let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. Song, let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, in other words, I love you.
And now, many years after the deaths of Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, and Duke Ellington, they're part of our musical history. Their records continue to be reissued. They're easily found for anyone who wants to hear their music. Is that the real test of who these men were, that all these years later, we still want to hear their music and know more about them?
Yes. So sadly, John, the other test is that all these years later, we still need a lesson on why racial justice matters in America. And these three guys give us that lesson. They teach us that it is not the way I learned it in civics class, where Plessy versus Ferguson leads to something else, which leads to the great Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision that was the ultimate decision in helping integrate America. That's not how social change happens. Social change, as Martin Luther King reminded us, happens when jazz musicians like these three take their music into millions, tens of millions of American homes. And when you listen to them and realize their musical genius, it is not such a long step to realize that maybe these kinds of geniuses deserve something close to equal rights.
And also, we can't overlook the fact that these three men, their careers roughly paralleled the advent of commercial radio, the phonograph record, and television later in their careers. All three of them sort of rode that crest of new media. As it came along, they were always there.
They were always there, to the point where, at I think it was age 64, the Louis Armstrong, with his song, It's a Wonderful World, knocked the Beatles off of number one in the Billboard charts. They were there, they were innovating, and they never lost their relevancy. And John, your career may last 50 years, and Dan Tridle, our engineer's career, hopefully will last 50 years. But these three guys were pretty darn unique in that they stayed at the top of their profession for a full half century.
Did you ever get the sense while you were researching Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie that these three were aware of their places in American musical history?
Yes. While they all pretended a modesty that was suggesting that, well, they didn't know how history would see them, they all were savvy enough that they knew that they would be carved there on the Mount Rushmore of jazz greats. And they would not just be there, they would be the three who would lead that procession. And they all had big enough egos that they understood just how great they were in this pantheon of jazz.
At the height of their careers, how important were they in the overall musical fabric of America?
They were central. They were central, but don't take my word for it. The idea that Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy sent them around the world as jazz ambassadors, the idea that everybody from Miles Davis to John Coltrane looked at them as their founding fathers, they understood just how important they were in this overall picture of jazz in America. And it is not accidental that in every poll that was done, these three came up as among the most identifiable Americans across the world. And that's not just the world of music.
Yeah, we can't forget that in the 20s, say through the 50s and 60s, when these three were at the height of their careers, jazz was also the dominant popular music in America. It later became, you know, replaced by rock and roll and other things. But when these three were really at the top, the music they were making was also the top form of music in America.
So that is exactly right. And Europe could claim classical music as its birthright. Calypso and lots of other forms of music were rightfully attributed to a Latin base, but jazz was the all-American music form. It was the popular music form. It's not accidental that they called that era the Jazz Age, and it was the Jazz Age, and it was the all-American music age where we finally had a form of music that we could say was all ours, and we gave it to the world.
Larry Tye's book is called The Jazz Man: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Larry Tye, thanks so much for talking with us.
Great to be on with you again.
Let's go out with Count Basie. I'm John Basile. Thanks for listening.